Bhartaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamani Santatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvaishini.
Verse 4, chapter 12.
Sanyam Yendriya Kramam Sanyam Yendriyam Kramam Sarvatra Samabhuddhayaha Sarvatra Samabhuddhayaha Te Prapnivanti Mameva Te Prapnivanti Mameva Sarvabhuta Hitevataha Sarvabhuta Hitevataha Samyamya Indriya Kramam Sarvatra Samabhuddhayaha Te Prapnivanti Mameva Sarva Bhuta Hite Rataha.
Now this verse actually finishes the previous verse, so let's read the previous verse also. I'll just we did this last time, I'll just break the sandhi again, and then I'm going to translate it along with this verse, since the two verses really belong together. Okay. It says, Yetu Aksharam Anirdesham Avyaktam Pariyupasate Sarvatrigam Achintyam cha kutastam achalam dhruvam. So here, I'll just read this. He says, whereas those who, now in this verse, in 3, he's differentiating the sannyasi whose life is just shravana manana nididhyasana. It's a life of contemplation, a life of studying this teaching, the one that that Arjuna wants to be. Running to the Himalayas and studying with the teacher and just spending a life of contemplation. Upon Brahman, upon Nirguna Brahman, you know, where the whole life is just studying really the Mahavakya, studying the Upanishads, and studying all the Prakarana Granthas, and having your whole life centered around the upasana, or the study, the contemplation of myself as the whole, as Brahman. And so here, he's differentiating these people, the sannyasis, from those who are practicing karma yoga and contemplation and meditation upon Ishwara, the Saguna Brahman. And so the two is the for differentiation. Two means just whereas, but it's just used to differentiate now these people as opposed to these people. So he says, you know, those who pariyupasate, those whose pariyupasate means, upasate means to contemplate upon, to have the mind upa, to have the mind sitting upon. So upasana, usually when we think of upasana, we think of the upasana upon an object or a devata or a particular form. Like I could do an upasana on the form of Shiva, Dakshinamurti, for instance. Or I could do an upasana on the sound of Om, not the meaning of Om, but on the sound of Om, or on the Omkara. So when we think of upasana, normally we think of it of meditating, holding the mind upon an image. That image could be holding the mind upon in a meditative stance, holding the mind on Saguna Brahman, means on Ishwara as the whole. And Swamiji's commentary, he's saying that itself is kind of difficult to do. To try to even imagine Saguna Brahman means to imagine the Maya Upadi, to meditate on Ishwara and Bhagawan as the whole. And to be able to just sit and hold those. Swamiji says, well, sometimes your mind will go, you know, maybe you'll be imagining Bhagawan as the sun and the moon, and then it'll go, well, what about the earth? What about the space on the right side and the left side? So, to be able to actually hold some sort of a image of Bhagawan as the whole is itself, you know, kind of a discipline and not that easy. He says, let alone to... Now, so upasana means that upa means near, asana means like... putting the mind, seating the mind near something, focused upon something. So for those sannyasis who are
doing upasana and pariupasana. Pariupasite, pari means in all directions. Whether I'm looking here or whether I'm studying the shastra, I'm doing shravana, where I'm actually engaged in studying or listening to the shruti, listening to the unfoldment, or my mind is doing manana, where I'm questioning it and debating, asking questions, why couldn't it be this way or that way? The shruti says it's this way, I understand, but why couldn't it be this way? That is manana. So my mind is engaged in that. So sitting near, I'm sitting on this. And then nididhyasana, where I'm recognizing my being as Brahman, the Satchidananda Brahman. And so that's what a sannyasi does. It's the putti means in all directions. Putti means like, if you have putti gacchati, for instance, it means I'm going all the way around. Circling. Say I'm studying something, and I use putti as a preposition, it means I'm thoroughly doing it from all directions. Yeah. And so here it's putti. Putti upasyate. Putti upasyate. It means that my whole life is devoted to this contemplation or reflecting upon the myself as Brahman. Okay. On so he says, where as those who are pariyupasate, who are doing this contemplation on that which is akshiram, free from any type of change or decay, anirdesham, that which is cannot be really described in any way because it's not an object, that which is avyaktam, unmanifest, it can't be objectified or manifest, it's avyaktam, and it's sarvatragam, there's no place where it's not. If I look out into this creation, there is no thing which is not Brahman. And so as I'm experiencing the creation, I should be recognizing that which is the same in all beings, that which is the same in all things. Beings, then, now if I say that which is the same in all beings, often we meet in the human beings, that which is the same in you, you and you. But that which is the same in all beings is also that which is the same in the chair, and that which is the same in the stars, and that which is the same in the space. You know, that which is the very, very being of all things. And so that's that sarvatragam. From the standpoint of the creation, there is nothing which is away from that. Sarvatragam. And achintyam. Achintyam means it can't be thought about because it can't be objectified. You know, when I talked quite a bit about this last time, but when we gain knowledge of the self, it's not an objectifiable knowledge. It's on every. When we gain knowledge of anything in the creation, the mind, through the use of sense perception or imagination or memory, is forming a vritti, a thought modification, which I then illumine. And so now, because I have illumined this thought modification, which is given to me, say, through perception or through imagination, whatever is taking place in that vritti is objectified and is illumined by me. So there's a subject-object relationship. But this knowledge is different than that. It's not an objectifiable knowledge. It's the knowledge of what is already present as the luminary. For instance, if I say, this thought is illumined by me, is known by me, I am conscious, I'm aware of the thought, all this type of language, that means that there's someone there, right? Because of whom this thought is known. That's one language. Because of me, this thought is known. Now, what if we want to, and so all of these thoughts are thoughts that are chintya, means they're vrittis that are available to me, thought modifications available to me from my means of knowledge. But now I want a thought modification of the one because of whom all thought modifications are known. Right? The awareness that illumines the thought modification is the one to be known. So this is a totally different state of affairs. Because the one who illumines all thought modifications, all thoughts that you have, the luminary, the conscious being, itself is already known experientially as me, the conscious being who is present to all of my experience. So I already am... we would say self-evident. My being is self-evident and not as an object. It's self-evident because being itself is consciousness. And so I am self-shining. I'm the bottom line. It's not, because just think of it like this. Every thought that you have, right, is known, and I the subject, because of me the subject, this thought is known. Now you don't go farther than that. That you don't go and then say, and because, and this me, this awareness, is known because of this awareness that's illumining it. And that awareness is known because of this awareness that's like some sort of an infinite regress. There is no such experience. There is a bottom line. And the bottom line is me. I can't get behind consciousness. Everything, in fact, consciousness is the substratum or the bottom line of all experience, and that consciousness is me. I don't take myself to be the objectified object. I always take myself to be the one who knows the object or because of whom the object is known. So underneath that, there's nothing. There's no way to go. And so space itself is objectified, let alone everything in it. And if space itself is objectified and therefore illumined by me, then in all experience that I have, I am Sarvatra Gam. Gam means I have gone. I go into Sarvatra. I go everywhere. Sarva means all. Sarvatra means everywhere. It also means at all times. It's tra is an affix. So gam, I've pervaded that at all times. So the bottom line is, even though myself am not objectifiable, right? I'm not subject to change. I can't be described as any type of an object, right? So not objectifiable. I am not a vritti, right? And I'm not the object of a vritti, but I am. There's no place in any given vritti or any given experience that's away from me. But I'm not the object of the vritti, and yet I'm the self of the vritti. And because I'm the self of the vritti, right, there is no experience that's away from that self. There's no vritti, no thought modification that is away from me, and yet the vritti is not illumining me, I'm illumining it. And so that makes knowledge very interesting, to gain knowledge of me, because the experientially that I already am, the self-experience is already there. I don't need a vritti to come in and give me my self-experience. The knowledge that we gain is one of really what we call ajnana nivritti, the elimination of the ignorance which has caused this mind to identify itself and its gunas, its qualities, with me, rather than recognizing whether the mind's recognizing what it is in light of the self that is the me that is self-evident and illumining it. That is the whole problem. So the mind has to recognize its relationship to the self-evident truth of my being, which is always there changelessly. That is the knowledge. And the knowledge is really the removal of ignorance. So there's a lot that can be said about that. Then he says, kutestam. Kutestam is the one, the myself is the one who's abiding in this maya. He's just abiding in the whole maya. And is achalam changeless, and dhruvam. Therefore, dhruvam means absolutely stable, the truth, infinite, eternal. And so now he says, these people who are the sannyasis, who are contemplating on me in all these ways, the akshram, anirdesham, avyaktam, sarvatragam, achintyam, kutastam, achalam, dhruvam. That's how they're holding that. Their mind is sitting in me, nirguna brahman, really, in myself, which is satchit ananda. Just sitting in me. And he says, now, what are these people like who are just spending their time, this parivipasate, they're just spending all of their time. This is what they do. They sit, you know, enjoying me, focused on me, recognizing me. Parivipasate, all of the time, in all ways. No matter what I'm doing, that's what I'm seeing. So what are they like? He says, so these people who are doing this, these sannyasis, he says, samyamya indriya gramam. Samyamya, niyamya means having totally controlled. Samyak means, niyamya means having control. Samyak means that you do, they have fully, in a very mature way, are totally have total control over their indriyas. Indriyani means the indriyas, the sense organs, and the organs of action. Okay. So having control over their sense organs and organs of action, indriyani, indriya gramam, samyam, the gramam means the group of indriyas. So the whole group of indriyas, you can take sense organs and the organs of action. So samyamya, having those under their control, and I'll go over all of these in depth, let's just look at the list. And then, sarvatra sambuddhiyaha, and they whose mind is everywhere, sarvatra, everywhere and at all times. That tra affix gives the sense of the locative sense. It can be in terms of time and place. So at all times and in every place, their mind is samabuddhiyaha. Their buddhi is always the same. In other words, there's an objectivity and a freedom from ragadvesha, a freedom from likes and dislikes. There's a mature vairagya there. So freedom from that sama means that their mind isn't shaken by the world, by the experiences of the world. You'll see in your own life that you're not shaken by probably 99% of your experiences. But that 1% is really big. But when you think of all the experiences you have, just think of how much input you have every day. Most of it, you have that samabuddhiyaha. Buddhi means, you know, the mind, the decisive mind, the mind that knows, the mind that is carrying your knowledge. That's the buddhi. The mind that carries your knowledge and your clarity. So that buddhi, you know, is always sama. It's always all your experiences. It's going to look like this. All the experiences that you have through your sense organs, your emotions, your memories, all the experiences that you have are held by that buddhi, by your buddhi, which is not toppled by them. Because what happens normally is that your buddhi is not strong enough, you know, not mature enough yet to not be toppled by some of the experiences the world throws at you. And so what happens is that it's kind of like if a big wave. I remember once when I was a little girl in Santa Cruz, and my parents had taken us to the ocean, and I was out there just wading along, you know, in the water. And a big wave came. And it was so big that it just covered over me and swept me out to the ocean. It swept me out. I still remember being underwater and my eyes looking, you know, around, you know. And all of a sudden another wave came and swept me back up and right into my father's legs. I'll forget it. And he picked me up, you know. But this is our experience. In a sense, we get, the buddhi gets overwhelmed by the experience, as though drowned out for the time being by the experience until the wave recedes. The good thing is that the waves recede. But when Swamiji will say, you know, this is the thing is, your knowledge always outlasts the waves. But the thing is that when the waves have overwhelmed, the waves of these experiences, you know, at the time that they're taking place, the buddhi is drenched by that experience and as though loses its clarity. But the experience pulls away, and then the buddhi goes, whoa. It can reflect, and it gains a distance, and it realizes what has happened and analyzes the situation, you know, can deal with the situation. But there comes a time, you know, when the buddhi, the waves cannot be bigger than your buddhi. That's what we call nishta, jnana nishta. When the waves of the experiences that happen, the waves of raga dvesha, no longer are stronger than your knowledge, then you have jnana nishta. And so that, such a buddhi like that is what we call sama buddhiyaha, means the mind is in all situations, it is the same. It's the same because it's rooted in the self, which is always the same, and the raga dveshas have been neutralized. When I say same, I don't mean flat. We have lots of different feelings and emotions and experiences. There's many textures to life. But those textures to life take place in you. They are experienced by you. They're experienced by your buddhi. And so the different textures of life don't have to throw the buddhi off. You don't have to swallow the buddhi. They don't swallow the buddhi, then those textures, those experiences are taking place in you, and you have a choice in the way that you respond to them. And so then if you have that choice, then you are the same in all of those experiences. So we're going one little level, let me say it like this. You're testing. Are we okay with sound there? Okay, we are. So, as you gain knowledge and as your mind is maturing in this knowledge, one thing that you can notice, even though you can have these overflowing waves, these waves overflowing the buddhi, you can recognize the changelessness of your own presence as the mind is going through all of its moods and feelings and reactions and whatnot. So that's one level of understanding, one beautiful level of understanding. Because at that point, even though the mind is behaving in ways that in fact are not really in line with your knowledge, different reactions and whatnot, raga dveshas and getting swept away in this way or that way, behaving in ways as you might as well be an ajnani from anybody else's perception. You know, and by the way, in chapter 13 of the Gita, Shankara says the only person that really knows if you know is yourself and your teacher. Because your mind can still be maturing and getting swept away in this way and that way, you know, by the world. Because really, ragas and dveshas, likes and dislikes that haven't been really assimilated yet. But as that is all happening for you, there's your own presence, which is not changing at all, and that's aparoksha, that's self-evident to you. You know? And there's also a mind, that's one level, so yourself can't be swept away, the self is known, and it can never be swept away. Once it's recognized, it's just abiding there in this chaos. There's another level of, I'd say, maturity, and that is where your mind is still behaving chaotically and as though you were an ajnani. It's behaving that way, you know. But your buddhi, even though it's not able to stop that behavior, so to speak, it's still very aware of it. And it is just comes to the aid of that more immature behavior. It comes, your own buddhi comes and helps out. And helps to bring the mind back. Okay? Well, that's even more mature. It means that you've had more time to for all of the different parts of your psyche to assimilate your knowledge. So now the buddhi is always there. It's helpful to the different renegades different children that are running about inside. It's helpful. But then, slowly but surely, as you mature in the light of your knowledge, you know, the parts that have kind of an emotional lag time, you know, the kind of leftover raga dveshas and emotions that are still, you know, working themselves out, there comes a time when these have, for the most part, worked themselves out. And so the mind, the buddhi, is not having to do that much caretaking of your own mind. But there's, for a long period of time, there's caretaking. But the buddhi still has that samabuddhi is still there, because the buddhi is caretaking the manas, the emotional part of your mind, the raga dveshas, and all those raga likes and dislikes that are there and starting to, wanting to act out. The buddhi, you know, can hold them. can hold them and say yes or no. And then if the raga dveshas are still at that time a little too powerful and they just sweep you away and you go on a merry ride with them, it will wear itself out, and then the buddhi will say, all right, now let's take a look at that. You see what I mean? This is how it works. But there, there comes a time when, because of your knowledge, all of these, all of your life experiences are taking place in your knowledge, the buddhi, which becomes more and more clear day in and day out. And as it becomes more clear, it becomes stronger. And stronger means the knowledge of the buddhi is stronger than the leftover ajnana in the mind, if that makes any sense. To the point that there's no one left, no parts left in the mind that really are driven to do something that goes against the reality. So, this example that we often use for raga dvesha of the helium balloon, you know, how the helium balloon for a little child is such a big treat, yeah, and important, and there can be so much grief when the balloon inevitably pops. You know, we use that example also because it doesn't take very long for the balloon to pop. This is not a very long-lived, the helium balloon experience is always a short-lived experience. So, in all of our experiences of ananda, really, our little bliss experiences in the world are for the most part pretty short-lived. You know, there's always something that comes in and wrecks it. Even your own tension or your own fear will come in and ruin, take away, you know, your happy experiences. There's many, many things that can come in and take those things away. Anyway, with a helium balloon, I want that so badly, and I just love having it, and I'm so sad when it leaves, when I'm a child. But there is a time, just in the course of our own maturing as a human being, when I am freed of the helium balloon. I'm freed of it completely. Now, that's vairagya. But that total freedom in reference to the helium balloon doesn't mean that I can't have fun, that I can't enjoy it, that I can't, you know, love it while it's here, play with it, all of these things. But it does mean that it's present, that my well-being is not, I have samatvam. That samatvam means that sameness. It's, I'm not going to get shaken when the balloon either arrives or departs. And it's not, because I've outgrown it very naturally. And so with your knowledge, you very naturally outgrow, you know, your need for things. Like, everything becomes like a helium balloon, because that doesn't, the important part, this is really the key to really understanding vairagya. It has nothing to do with lack of appreciation, with lack of love, with lack of the wonder of how beautiful something is, you know, or how precious a relationship is, or all of these type of things. These things aren't destroyed at all. In fact, once Swamiji said, the person who would make the best partner in life is a jnani, and the best parent. He says, I would be the best father. Imagine. You know? But why? You know, because objective, that objectivity that can actually be present to someone, present to your situation, because your well-being isn't dependent upon it staying or being in a particular way. And so you're really free to be with the situation. That is maturity. Now, so when we say that sannyamya, indriya grahamam, this whole group of indriyas, when I have that type of control, that control isn't the control of hanging on to the reins tightly. It's a control, the control of maturity. Where really is your, what is really the source of your ananda? When the mind really knows that in reference to all of your experience, then these experiences can be what they are. They're not contributing to my ananda. The source of every experience of ananda, wholeness, bliss, whatever the mind ever has, the only source of it really is your being. It's just that because of samsara, we are led to believe a grand illusion that is actually pervasive to the whole Maya. And so we're all in it. And since we're all in it together, we're all in this illusion together, we can believe in it. And what it is across the board is every time you fulfill a desire, it's just this simple. Every time you fulfill a desire, at that moment, your mind has shanti. It's desireless at that moment. It doesn't take long for other desires to come, or fears or worries, desires in the negative. Like, for instance, I fulfill a desire and I have shanti, and then I have a desire in the negative form. Oh, I hope nothing takes this away. You know? It could be any type of desire comes and it takes away that shanti. But for that moment, your mind is freed, because at that moment you're free of desire. And in that moment, it's like the clear water bucket, you know, reflecting the sun. And so that your being is just manifests in that vritti, and at that time the vritti, the thought modification, experiences its own form of ananda. To the degree that the vritti is very, very quiet and subtle, to that degree, the more blissful and divine the experience is. You know, and this is what keeps us going. These little, what in the Upanishads actually they call these little leshas of ananda. Leshas means these little sprinkles of ananda. The little sprinkles of ananda that the different degrees of quiet mind give us. And we get those quiet mind in variety of ways, but they so often it's just through the fulfillment of a desire. You know. And so that's what keeps us going. And so even for a samsari, your experience of ananda, and this isn't really true, but it is true in terms of your own perception of your experience, is only in relation to your experience of dukkha, sukha and dukkha. Because the experience of ananda that you're acknowledging is only the bliss or happy thought modification, which is really a shantavritti, like a clear water bucket. So those moments of peaceful mind through the fulfillment of desire, are your experience of happiness. You know, and those experiences of happiness are short-lived because agitation from the world and, you know, comes in quickly. But this is what you know as ananda. But what is being missed there is that really the source, the ever-present source of the ananda, you know, which reflects in its own way in a quiet mind, that ever-present source of ananda as myself is there, never coming and going. But once I realize the relationship of the shantavritti to that which is ever-present, to my being that is ever-present, my mind no longer wants this circuitous route. I don't need an object to give me a shantavritti. You don't need an object for that. You can just do some breathing exercises. You know, you can do some exercises and some breathing exercises and get a shantavritti. The ananda doesn't exist in the world. It doesn't exist in the object. It is the very swarupa, the very nature of yourself. And so once the mind has discovered this, more and more does not go along as it discovers it in a way of not only experience, but an understanding of the experience, knowledge. So as the mind, as the buddhi really knows, it no longer needs to be controlled, because it knows the source of ananda, and what every human being, every animal, what the universe seeks is ananda. Wholeness, well-being, that all is well with me. I don't care if it's an animal or an insect or a human being. All living creatures seek the well-being, which is my own nature. Now, because of ajnanam, I've superimposed my nature onto all of these objects, and then I go and try to get it. But what about when I realize that the source of the ananda that I was seeking out here is really the very nature of the seeker? And then as my mind understands this more and more and more, It doesn't want to go out here. It can appreciate everyone and everything. But it doesn't want to depend on something for ananda, which first of all doesn't have it. Right? And second of all, is absolutely finite in every way that we look at it, and is away from me, and I don't have any control over it. You know, any time I try to exert control, I just get into more and more hot water. You know, nobody or no thing likes to be controlled. You know. And so the mind gives up on all of that. And as it gives up on it, it is highly rewarded. And because it's highly rewarded, because the giving up of it gives you a shantavritti, so it's highly rewarded by that peace, by that ananda, it gives up more because it's even more highly rewarded. Yeah. And so this is the process of maturing. And so he says, sam niyamya indriya gramam. He says, the mind has control over the buddhi, or over the sense organs. It has control because of knowledge, not because of, you know, of handcuffs. It's not about handcuffs. It's knowledge, you know. And even when the mind is acting up, it's knowledge that brings it back, you know. And at some point, it doesn't have to be told anymore, because it is understood and it likes to stay home. The reward is very great. You know, just think of this. Where would you rather be? Where the ananda actually is, or where it really isn't? So as you realize where it actually is, that's where the mind, you know, kind of like moths to the flame, you know, the buddhi, you know, focuses more and more and revels in the self. There's so many, as we'll see, so many verses in the Gita on how, you know, the buddhi of the jnani revels. It revels in the self. The mind revels in the self because the mind revels in ananda. The ajnani revels in the self, which has been projected on something. That's what we're all doing. We're all reveling in the self, which has been projected erroneously on something else. That's why we're continually disappointed because the something else, you know, doesn't have it. That's the problem with projection. You know, it's very disappointing. So having this niyamya, this natural control over the sense organs, and the mind being the same everywhere. You know why? Another thing to understand that samatva, yourself is always the same. Your being is not subject to change. You can't take it away. Nobody can take it away. You can't even get any distance on it. Well, I have to have it, but you know, let me just go over in this corner and it can stay in this. No, it'll be in wherever corner you go. It is there. There's no getting away from it. And so because there's no getting away from it, your mind can't escape it, and it is ananda. You know, your mind doesn't have fear. This is where the abhayam is, because the self is free of time. It's free of change. And it is the self of the mitya, the self of the mind. So there's nothing the mind need do. This is the only place where there's no source of fear. Any place in samsara, within time and space, there's fear. Because everything is subject to change. Everything is subject to birth and death. And so there's nothing here you can hang on to. But the only thing that is absolutely free is your being. And your being is not going to go anywhere, nor can it go anywhere. It can't do anything to itself either. Ishwara can't do anything to it. So it is absolutely whole and complete and free. And your mind, which is satyam mitya, clay pot, you know, your mind also can't do anything to it, nor can it get away from it. And so once it's recognized that the source of ananda is its very being, that mind has nothing more to achieve. That's what mind will say. What needs to be done has been done by me. That alam buddhi. You know, it's like kritya kritaha, that which is to be done, that has been done. I'm whole, I'm free, it's enough, fine, I don't need anything. Because the source of everything that you seek in the world is your own being, and you've discovered it. And so now, over time, the whole mind, with all of its multi avenues and multi voices, and multi levels of maturity, the mind is kind of a complex family. All of these parts, over time, very naturally mature in the light of your knowledge. There's not much you can do about it. You can't, like Swamiji used the example for maturing. He uses the example of a little rosebud. And the little child wants to see what it looks like when it grows up and is a flower. I want to see the flower. And so the little child takes that little bud and they're pulling it apart to make it a flower. Well, the poor little rosebud does not get to really become the flower that it would have become had we just watered it and taken care of it. And so that's our maturing process. That's why part of the beauty of this understanding, if you understand these parts of it, they're so important. Because then your buddhi can become like a good parent to that maturing process. So you don't ask all of the different parts of you, of your mind, to mature at the same time. It's like, all right, you heard this knowledge and you're not acting like you're supposed to be. It's very, you can be very punishing. But if you really understand, just as you would raise a child and kind of delight in watching yourself and your mind mature, and we know, as your mind is maturing, it's not that you don't know. And you feel happy as these kind of reactions and, things start, and pains and, needs slowly are dropping off. That's a wondrous thing. And then to enjoy the process, and to kind of give, the sun and water and fertilizer and everything, protect that beautiful process and respect it, rather than thinking that you're supposed to overnight, be a great Mahatma. A greatly mature person overnight. It's not realistic. It's not how it is. And so Bhagavan says, when he's talking this, someone who sanniyamya indriya gramam, this is a person, a sannyasi, who has really matured over time through really karma yoga, that ishwararpana buddhi, following Dharma and all of these things in the light of Shravana Manana Nididhyasana, in the light of my knowledge, then all of these things I've practiced, giving the buddhi like a field of experience, a field where all of these complexes and things can work out until all that's left is just me with my knowledge. All the different parts of my psyche are held, beautifully held by that. So that takes some time. So now he says, such a person, then he gives another beautiful quality of such a person, sarva bhuta hite ratama. And such people, they rejoice in the well-being and happiness of all beings. That's because they themselves are happy. When you're happy, then it's all right for other people to be happy. When you're whole and complete, then you enjoy and help, want to always help and enjoy the wholeness and happiness of others. That's natural for all of us as human beings when we are happy. When we're not happy, then sometimes it's hard to be so gracious. Because they're happy and I'm not happy. Well, you get to be happy and I'm not happy. Whatever kind of feelings that come our way, But when you are settled in your life, then you're happy with others being settled also and being happy also. So that's natural. That's natural to all beings when you are just abiding in your nature. But there's so much ajnanam there, that we're swept away all of the time. So we spend a great deal of time swept away into samsara. but through really karma yoga, or even before karma yoga, just living a dharmic life, being a good person, gain enough space to start gaining these qualities of an adhikari, of a qualified student. So if we, when we go through the qualities of the adhikari, you already, adhikari means somebody who's interested at all in getting this knowledge. Most people are not adhikaris, and how would you know? Well, because they have absolutely no interest in this. If you drag them to class, it's going to be a long wait for them. And you've really, you've really done a mean thing to them.
Adhikari.
Adhikari means a qualified student for this knowledge. Qualified student just means a person for whom this knowledge is useful. So some of these qualities of the adhikari are, like for instance, viveka. That's the first one, viveka. Viveka means a person is able to discriminate nitya, anitya. Anitya means that which is time-bound. Nitya means that which is free from time. Well, the adhikari who comes to this knowledge doesn't know what is nitya, free from time. But they do know that everything they experience is time-bound. They do know that. But with knowledge that viveka is complete, you know the nature of maya, yama iti maya, that which is not, means it has no substantial being of its own at all. You know, it's subject to birth and death and continual change. It is incapable by its very nature of giving you anything lasting. Impossible, because it itself is continually changing. And adhikari knows this. And this recognition is what causes a huge problem, because they don't know it just partially. They realize that this is the nature of the entire universe and everything in it. And there's nothing I can do about it. That this is the nature of the universe, that it is subject to continual change, and that being the case, I can't expect it to give anything lasting on any level. And so then the question is, well, how is there anything which is real? That's the question, because I know that it's not to be found here. And then you will throw your hands up to Bhagawan and become a mumukshu, somebody who desires liberation. To become, that's another quality, mumukshutvam. I won't desire liberation as a mumukshu if I feel I can solve the problem. If you can solve the problem, then the word mumukshu doesn't apply to you. You're still somebody who can take control of the situation, gain enough knowledge, get enough skills, you know, improve yourself enough to become whole and complete and be able to say, all is well with me. I have made it in life. All is well. I'm whole and complete. If you think that you can accomplish that, you know, then you're not a mumukshu. You know, you can know, I can get glimpses of that, and you can be semi-satisfied with a relative, you know, peacefulness, but there's no resolve. And there's not a resolve, and there can't be, because you can't resolve yourself in something that is finite. And so there's always a holding back, and there's always a sorrow to your love. There's always a sorrow to your joy, because you love so much, but what you love is not immortal. What you love is mortal. And so all joy is accompanied by an underlying sadness. And so you know this. And so that viveka that brings about the mumukshutvam causes a vairagya, which initially is kind of a sour grapes vairagya in this sense. To put all of my, I cannot get from these things in the world what I'm actually seeking. That's the vairagya. It's a knowledge. And I can't get from the world what I am seeking. And now before the viveka was there, I thought that I could get from the world what I was actually seeking. When I realized that I can't get from the world what I'm actually seeking, then that pursuit loses its luster. You know, and that's what we call the vairagya. But that vairagya resolves itself into ananda, right? Because this can't give me that, right? But what happens is, a mature vairagya is what is the helium balloon. I don't ask it to give me that, because I have it. And so the vairagya fulfills itself in the knowledge of the ananda that I had wanted to get from the creation is really my own being. So the vairagya completes itself. You see what I mean? The viveka also completes itself with the recognition of what is nitya, which is the self. The vairagya, the recognition of where the ananda is lying. Where has it been hiding all these years? It's my own being. And so the viveka causes the mumukshutvam, right? And the viveka leads to the vairagya, and that all causes the mumukshutvam because I realize I can't solve the problem. And then there's these very important group of six mental qualifications that really come from this viveka vairagya. It's a natural maturing that comes about from these two recognitions, the viveka and the vairagya, and the seeking for something, you know, the mumukshutvam. The first one is that shama, where I'm able to have a choice over my thoughts. I'll get into this maybe a little more next week. But shama, where I can control my thoughts, is control in this sense. I don't continue to get so overwhelmed by my thoughts that I can let a thought go before it embodies me, before it grips me. Now, dhamma is when shama fails and I have become overwhelmed by the thought. Dhamma is such an important quality for gaining antikarana shuddhi, because what dhamma does is, I have to become strengthened this ability, to when I become overwhelmed by a mood or an emotion, the ability to not act out. Like say I become very angry about something, so now the shama has gone away. I'm overwhelmed by my anger. Okay. Now, what do I do with that anger? Can I be with it? Or is it so intense for me that it has to spew, right, in many directions? So the ability to sit with something, I even think, because, you know, all of us spew in one way or the other, but you can get into the habit of waiting 10 minutes before you do it. Really, I'm totally serious. If something overwhelms, to sit with it for a period of time before you act it out, before you act on it. And everything we say, all these little type of exercises and things, they're all in the light of your knowledge. Because what they're doing, what these exercises do is strengthen your buddhi, which is used to, your buddhi is used to just letting go. If the manas comes, you know, some big reaction comes up, then it overwhelms the buddhi and you just go with it. So what I'm saying is that you can build up that muscle. The buddhi is a muscle where, no, here it's here, but no, we're not going to go with it immediately. And if it's really big, you say, okay, well, 1 minute. Just do something, because you're building up strength. You know, what happens, honestly, it's so very rewarding. It's so rewarding because when you don't let yourself get carried away, and it's like being able to withstand the tidal wave, and then it goes and you're still standing. That feels really, really nice. Mm-hmm. You know? So you can't be, you have to, you know, just like they say when you're doing yoga or doing exercises, you don't want to push yourself beyond what is comfortable, what is healthy, but just to work with it a little bit, you know? So you're teaching your mind. It's like parents teach their children, you know, that parents don't let their children act out, and the children don't necessarily like to be corralled all the time. You know, but they have to also learn these type of disciplines. And there's certain ways maybe that you can see in your own mind where certain things your mind takes over, even though, and your buddhi just backs down. It just succumbs. And I'm just saying, just as a little practice, don't succumb right away. Build up that strength. That's the Dhamma. And there comes a time when Shama rules. When Shama rules, you don't even need Dhamma. But there comes a time then, before that, when Dhamma rules. Means, if you say no, that we're not going to act out on that. We're not going to do that. You know, because it goes against our values, and it's not, you know, it's not where I want to go. Then the mind is okay. And after a while, it doesn't even raise it. It doesn't raise its head because you're the master. The buddhi is the master, you know, and it knows that. And so it's kind of nice to be a good parent to your mind in that way. You know, it's like you would want your child, you know, to have some controls. It's good for the child to have some controls. Anyway, so you can go on and on with it. Anyway, so what he says, all of these things of the Shama, Dhamma, Paticitta, Diksha, Shraddha, Samadhanam, all of these, I'll get into them maybe some, I'll make a note and get into some more next week for all of these. But all of these qualities are natural to a mind, to the mind of a jnani that is mature. Right? So it's just simply a mature mind, which is your birthright, really. When you gain knowledge, this is the type. This is who you are when there's not a problem, right? When there's not an emotional problem, when the agnanam isn't there, then this is just who you are naturally, and you have all of these qualities in some degree. You know, they're just not totally fulfilled and matured. But he says, for whom though all of these things are matured, that person who contemplates on me as the self as I am. Is that person who gains me. And it's a different type of a gain. It is a praptasya prapti. It is a gain of the gained. I'm already gained. You can't gain me any more than I am. But the gain of the gained is the removal of that ajnanam, and the mind just revels in the self that I am without any obstructions. It says that person, as the mind naturally matures, you know, that this is what you are. This is a mature mind. And this mature mind isn't, when Arjuna asked this question, you know, now should I take sannyasa or karma yoga? Which would be best for me? You do karma yoga to help the mind and body and your whole being mature into this. You don't choose this. Mm. This is the end. Mm. This is the mature person. So now you have to choose the karma yoga, and then in karma yoga, you know, what is very helpful in karma yoga? That's what you need to do, you know? And in both the person who, say, goes to the forest or stays in the world, both are mumukshus, both are doing the shravana, manana, nididhyasana. For both, their life is committed to this knowledge. But Arjuna is asking Krishna, yeah, but what will get me there the most quickly? And wouldn't just taking sannyasa right now get me there most quickly? Don't you think so? And Krishna says over and again, absolutely no. I really don't think so. But in either case, you're going to get knowledge, but it's that karma yoga buddhi, living in this field of experience, that allows the mind, you know, to grow. Yeah. The buddhi will grow in the light of your experience of raga dvesha, the light of who you are now in this setting. Let your knowledge, you know, your knowledge will allow the manas to mature, all of the different parts of the mind to mature in this setting, so that this in fact will be your forest, and then you can go to the forest. When this is your forest, then you can go to the forest. That's a really good idea. So let's stop there. Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Remind me what shravana is.
What is?
Shravana.
Shravana.
Oh,
yeah.
Shravana.
Shravana. Oh. So there's three. When we talk about them, we can divide, you know, the sadhanas, the means for gaining self-knowledge, into two different branches. One is for gaining antakarana shuddhi, a pure mind. Pure mind just means a mind that's available to this knowledge. That's karma yoga. The other is for the actual transmission, the actual gaining of the knowledge, and that's through shravana, manana, and nididhyasana. So shravana comes from the root shru, to hear. And so the shruti is considered a revealed knowledge, which is, so it's beginningless, which is, has to be heard and understood by the student. So that teacher-student relationship, where the Upanishads or the Vedanta is being taught to the student, and the student comes to understand clearly what the Upanishad is saying. That's shravana. So you're actually gaining knowledge of what the Upanishad says clearly. And you can have a lot of questions. Well, when the Upanishad says this, what do they mean exactly? Do they mean this or do they mean that? But your inquiry in shravana is clarity of understanding what the Upanishad is actually saying. What is its vision? Manana is a little different. Manana is reflecting upon it, thinking about it, and coming up with whatever doubts you might have. Say, well, the Upanishad says this, but why couldn't it be like this? I know what the Upanishad says. I see that, but I have this doubt thinking it could also be this way. And so now, it's not about understanding what the Upanishad says. It's questioning the veracity of what the Upanishad is saying. That is manana, where we're kind of shaking the post. You know, why we use that example of a post in a post hole. You know, when you make a fence, then what happens is when you dig the hole. At first, it's the post is like this, but as you go in pounding dirt into the hole more and more, and then you shake it some more, then pound more dirt in, it gets so it's very firm. And so that's what we call nishta. You can't shake it anymore. And so manana, shravana, is that listening to the teaching until you see it, you understand it, but manana is whatever doubts you might have. But how could that be true? Why couldn't it be like this? Nididhyasana is contemplation on the knowledge that you've received. Nididhyasana is like meditation, but you have to understand it's not meditating to gain something, it's meditating upon what you've gained, what you've known, what you've seen at the time of teaching, so that you can give the mind a chance to get rid of this dehatma buddhi. Dehatma buddhi means the buddhi, the conviction. Here, buddhi here means conviction. That the deha, the body, is the atma, is the self. So when we contemplate, you know, do nididhyasana on the self as Chaitanya, as consciousness, as Brahman, aham brahmasmi, or as Ishwaroham, I am Ishwara, or Shantoham, Anandoham, all of these type of mantras, they don't have to be in Sanskrit, it's the I am consciousness. We just say something like that because we know what consciousness means. If I say, I am consciousness, I already know that, and I've recognized the truth of it. But now I give my mind a chance to sit with that fact. Or if my vision is clear and I say, I am Ishwara. You know, I bring my mind into a contemplative state by doing japa and pranayama and all of the different things that we do in order to make the mind absorbed, and then in, with an absorbed mind, then I bring in that vision and I sit with it. Because that will give the mind time to get to know me, to get to know myself, rather than the usual prior condition of being just totally, the mind being totally identified with awareness, so that the awareness is the mind. And the mind is located in this body. So I, the awareful being, am this body-mind complex. That's what we start with. And but what we end with is I am the whole. So there's quite a jump, right, in terms of the mind's commitment. Because when a person starts out in this knowledge, the what we call anyonya adyasa, that superimposition, is total. You know, I experience myself as this body-mind, and I hope there's some soul that goes to heaven or, you know, is reborn, but I don't know what that is. I hope it's me or somebody that, you know, but I don't really know. And so we go from this total identification to a recognition, you know, of the freedom of my own being and myself as Ishvara. So Nididhyasana helps, is used to help break that, the strength of that conviction that we bring to this teaching. So Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. These three are called Upayanishta. These are the three sadhanas for the teaching, you know, for gaining this knowledge. Where Upayanishta means where I'm looking for nishta in the Upaya, means the mind that needs to be able to hold this knowledge. Like we want the mind, instead of to be, Swamiji's used the example. I actually think it's in one of these Prakarana Granthas where the mind is likened to a newspaper, you know, trying to hold coals, burning coals. You don't want your mind to be like a newspaper holding burning coals. You know, you want it to be like a strong, firm cauldron or something, you know, that can easily carry the coals of this knowledge, like that. And so the Upayanishta is the karma yoga, you know, and the different upasanas and things that we do to give what they call either antakarana shuddhi, which is purity of mind, means that as a certain shanti and space to allow the mind to really gain this knowledge. And the other one is for antakarana naischalya, which means the ability for the mind to stay in one place, to hold itself firm. And we use upasana and different techniques for developing that strength. Because say your mind, like for instance, if we're reading a book and you realize two paragraphs have gone by, you had no idea. That's that lack of naischalya. So you can notice that when you're doing shravana, like in this class, your mind will wander off, and then you've missed it. Those parts are gone. So now you come back, and here we are again. But what if that's your mind's doing that all of the time? Say, what if, like, you know, 50 or 60% of the class, your mind is not here, your body's here, but your mind is not. And so that naischalya is naischalya means that state of being steady. And so there's different exercises and things we can do to help the mind, you know, and different attitudes like the karma yoga buddhi to help the mind have attitudes that are conducive to gaining this knowledge. Those attitudes themselves are not the knowledge, but they bring about a mind that is very close to the mind of a jnani, even though it's relational and has to do with the relationship of you to Bhagavan. But it can bring about a relatively mind that has relative shanti and that has an ego that has been, where your ahankara has been lessened. What's that word? Like, made, you know, just made a lot more. It's not as strong. Something like that. The ahankara, that ego is pacified to. Because surrender to Ishvara. Surrender to Dharma. Where it's not about you. It's not about your raga dveshas. It's not about you getting fulfilling your likes and dislikes. It's all about what is the proper action in this situation, and that proper action Dharma, you know, we see as Bhagavan, as Ishvara. And so that it weakens very much weakens the Ahamkara. And so Swamiji has often said, you know, that the person who has that Karma Yoga Buddhi is so close to a jnani, even in terms of the ananda, the shanti they enjoy. It's just a hair's breadth. It's one little, you know. And so that's why this whole Bhagavad Gita really is these two things. The Shravana Manana Nididhyasana and Karma Yoga. And it does a lot for that. Whole chapter 6 also is on meditation. So all the coming at it from all different ways, everything that you need to mature. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, in the book, the 8 selected passages, there was a place where Swamiji was saying that, you can try to control your thoughts, but forget it. Like somebody tells you to not think of an elephant.
Yeah.
So yeah. What the relation does that have to the idea that you can monitor your thoughts?
Well, it would be like this. You're not going to be able to stop the thought flow because then you would have to stop the mind. So the mind is always going to be thinking, and if you tell the mind not to think about something, and in fact that's a great story and a great joke, you just try it. Don't think of an elephant. Then you're going to go around thinking of an elephant all the time. Plus the mind's going to go, don't think of an elephant, elephant. So here, it isn't about that. It's about, do you have a choice in the shama? Means as these thoughts come up, you're not stopping the thoughts, but do they have the capacity to overwhelm you? You know, if they do have the capacity to overwhelm you, then it's not about even stopping that. It's about bringing some knowledge to that. And there's different ways of handling these overwhelming thoughts. We can do it by doing some inner child work, because the little one that's coming up, little child inside that's coming up and needs some sort of holding. Or we can bring our knowledge to it. There's different ways of handling these type of thoughts. So those are transforming the thoughts. They're not stopping the thoughts. Okay, now another thing. Say we have to do Dhamma, where, again, it's not stopping the thought. We're not starting this, I'm not saying don't have that thought. So you can have that thought, but we're not going to act it out. You know, otherwise you would have to say, oh, if I have a thought to hit somebody, then, you know, I can't control my thoughts, so let me hit. That isn't true. It's not about controlling your thoughts, it's about controlling the way you act upon your thoughts, and that you can do it. Now say, your mind is running rampant. Then there's exercises that you can do to, you know, to work on your mind, to give it some muscle. You know, so that you can direct the mind. But that is different than trying to stop thinking. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's a lot of it is education. Like say, for instance, we all, as mumukshus and people who are maturing in this knowledge, we have a value for kindness. You know, because we've experienced it, because it's a dharma. One of the dharmas that, you know, we love to receive other people's kindness, and so then you also want to be kind yourself, because you know what it is to receive a person's kindness. What a beautiful thing that is. And so you have a value for it. And yet, sometimes you're not kind. Sometimes you're unkind. Well, that is also how it is. But say we want to work on that. We're very free to work on it. You know? That's not stopping your thoughts. It's working on your thoughts. Like, say, you tend to get angry and be unkind. Right? That's what happens. So you can decide, I'm going to work on that. How am I going to work? Well, one thing, you can do an auto-suggestion. Next time you want to say something like that, you know, let me think, try to be kind. You can just have a little mantra, try to do this. You know, you can seem gamey, But you know what? It isn't. It isn't because it's your value. It's your value, and yet your mind, you know, hasn't had enough time to really work on that value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many things that you can choose to work on, and the things we should choose to work on are the things that cause us and others pain. If we cause somebody else pain, you're causing yourself pain. That's just, you know, how the creation works. So we're mumukshus. We work on these things. And, you know, it's a work that takes place over years, not over days. Maturing into a big person is over years we do that. And if you don't have to do it over years, that means you did a lot of work last life. And what makes it even possible at all, and this neutralization of raga dvesha and all of this that cause all the problem, is because you are the source of ananda. Otherwise, it's really an uphill battle, because the projection of ananda onto the world is there, and then I need that to be happy, and then I get frustrated because somebody's taking my happiness away from me. With the situation, the world, Bhagavan, it's taking my happiness away from me, you know? And so it's kind of a losing battle, because you're away going against the most instinctive, natural pursuit of all beings is to be whole. And I've projected it out there. That's why we have so many problems in the world. You know, because you ask people, you don't have to be whole. Let me be whole, you know? Or you people over there, you don't need to be happy, because if you're happy, then I don't get what I want. It's a mess, you know. But what about when you have that solution inside that you know, and then working on these things, you're just trying to, you know, help the mind mature in the light of your knowledge by bringing in a little discipline here and there. You don't even have to do all of that, because your knowledge will create that anyway. But you may like to do it. You know, it's fun to work on yourself. Yeah. Especially the areas that are causing pain. You can say, you know, how can I work on this? What can I do that's in harmony with what I know? It's nice. It's like for some people, I mean, some people practice yoga every day. They do asanas every day because it's helpful and it feels good. You can do the same with mental emotional disciplines because it's helpful, it feels good. And it also, another thing is that all of those things, eventually they just drop off. They're not a practice that you need. Because the nature, when, as this ignorance, you know, cleans out, as the knowledge cleans out all of that ignorance, there's no tendency. It's like you're not going to keep, you know, circling around the snake once you see it's a rope. Right? You're just not. You're not going to be afraid of it and all of these kind of things. You're afraid of the snake, but not the rope. And so as you start seeing, then the reactions that are caused by ignorance can naturally drop off. Yeah. It's all natural. I don't feel a little blabby at this point.